Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Butler University of the education policy world, Andy Smerick.
I'm the underdog? I almost win stuff?
You're a Cinderella story.
I get beat by Duke?
All of those things. Yeah. Andy, you're, underdog, right, come from behind, hitting above your weight. I wanted to bring in this point because you know where our other regular host Rick Hess was on Monday night?
Hawaii.
He was watching the Duke-Butler game in person in Indianapolis.
How did that happen?
I kid you not. He was in Indiana for some talk with the Mind Trust promoting his book, and one thing led to another. He ended up in some excellent seats watching the championship game. This is the life that Rick Hess leads. Are we all jealous?
The gilded life of Rick.
We are all jealous. So.
He deserves it. He works hard.
He does work hard. And, his book, I think, he's promoting it a lot. I'm sure it's doing well. But it's not number 16 on the New York Times bestseller list.
So who is number 16 on the New York Times bestseller list, Mike?
Of course, Diane Ravitch's.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Number 16.
Gosh.
So the question is, when was the last time an education policy book did this well? I mean, maybe Jonathan Kozol's stuff? Maybe
I don't think Clayton Christensen's did this well. I don't think Chubb or Moe or I know. Yeah,
she's a phenomenon.
But next year, Andy Smerick and Mike Petrilli's books.
Yep, we're coming at it. We're gonna be like number one and number two on the list, and we'll be like Duke and Butler.
What a segue!
All right, enough with that, Andy. Lots to cover today. We have not been together for the show since Race to the Top. We're going to talk about that today.
Great.
We weren't here last week, of course, because it was our special April Fool's Day edition. We've only heard from a few listeners that were a bit confused with the program last week, which, as I recall, Laura, what did people end up hearing if
the
they...
The Lamb by William Faulkner.
The Lamb by William Faulkner.
Read by someone with a British accent.
Read by someone with a British accent. We do hope you enjoyed that. If you listened to the
funny whole
thing, you probably made yourself smarter.
Hmm.
It might have been less of a waste of time than usual. Okay, but this time we're going to do we're going to do Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to rate that reform, and then we're going to hear the Research Minute with our special guest. Amber is on jury duty this week, so it's going to be special intern Daniela with a special Research Minute.
Big shoes to fill.
Big shoes to fill. Okay, Mickey, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
The Race to the Top finalists were announced last week to much buzz in the ed policy sphere. Were you pleased or disappointed by the ed department's decision to award to Tennessee and Delaware?
Okay, so on my list, Tennessee and Delaware were fifth and fourth best, so I think they were good choices. I thought there were a couple that were better than those that didn't make the cut. So the big discussion since then has been, why did these two states win? And there's this debate going on, how much does union or stakeholder support matter, and do unions and districts and superintendents have a veto over applications now? And although they do have a good bit of power, when you take a look at all the scores that came out from the Department of Education, you can quickly see that Rhode Island and, say, Florida and Louisiana and some other states didn't do so well, not only because of lack of union support, but because they just missed points, really, the teacher quality and data systems and so forth. I'm more encouraged than I had been that there can be good states that win in round two, even if they don't bend over backwards just to get unions to agree to everything. So I'm relatively confident that we could have a pretty good round two.
You know, one thing that's interesting since this all came out is we're now seeing people in mainstream outlets, I mean, editorial board, The Washington Post, and other, digging into the minutiae of how these competitive programs work, how the scores are done. Governor Ritter in Colorado said it was like having a,
The
Russian judge back in the 80s. This is the kind of thing that happens any competitive competition at the U.S. Department of Education. There's always rogue reviewers. There's always kind of weird things that come up. What's funny is that this is getting so much attention because it's such big money. The question is, for the second round, can they make any tweaks so that it comes out where the most reform-minded states win? Or if the points don't come out right, will they be willing to use some judgment and override the reviewer scores and go for the states that are doing the heaviest reforms?
Oof.
That's treacherous.
That is treacherous.
But it might be the right thing to do.
You and I would jump probably all over them if they...
We would.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
They can't win on this.
But we'll also jump all over them if they don't. Okay,
sorry, guys.
Topic number two.
All right. A new Minnesota law intended to ramp up charter school quality is leading many public districts to consider scaling back or even eliminating their work as charter school sponsors, leaving private or nonprofit sponsors to take their place. Is this good for the charter movement?
Yes. Look, I'll be honest, I don't know enough about the details in Minnesota to understand exactly what the law requires, but the intention was a good one. It was to say, look, we've got to pay attention to charter authorizer quality. We've got too many entities out there that are sponsoring charter schools that either don't really want to be doing it or are doing it for the wrong reasons, aren't putting the capacity, the staff behind it that's needed to do it right. And so we're going to have some standards. And as a result of putting some standards in place, some school districts are saying, you know what, it's not worth it for us to get involved in this. I think, you know, sponsoring charter schools is hard. We do this in Ohio as a nonprofit there, Fordham does. You know, you've got to really be committed to doing it and doing it right, and even then it's hard to do it right. You can only imagine school districts that are doing it begrudgingly aren't doing a very good job. As a result, many of their schools aren't doing that great.
Yeah, this is an interesting policy, and it just shows Minnesota's on the cutting edge again. It's fascinating. Back in the day, we always used to assume that school districts had to own all public schools. So when chartering came up as an idea, it was natural to say, okay, districts do public schooling, therefore they need to do charter authorizing as well. But over time, it became really clear, well, running district schools is completely different as a core competency than authorizing schools. So it's actually showing that there are two different functions in the way that you can actually start schools, operate schools, monitor schools. I'm in favor of it.
Topic number three, Mickey.
All right. The hype for virtual and online schooling seems to be snowballing with recent publications from Rick Hess and Paul Peterson on this topic. Is e-learning the silver bullet for American education?
Mickey, first of all, what did Rick write about this?
Well, this is kind of tangential, but his new book with Mary Cole Lane on the School of the Future in Philadelphia does touch a lot on technology and learning, e-learning.
Okay.
Not virtual learning, but he certainly mentions and does a good review of the hype and the interest in virtual learning.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, sure.
I thought I'd missed another Rick Hess book that snuck in there among all the other ones. Andy, what do you think? Is virtual schooling, does it deserve the attention it's getting right now?
So I feel like I've been behind the curve on this, and I've been sort of in the position of being the conservative who has his heels dug in, almost as a Luddite, saying, listen, all this e-learning stuff is going way too fast. We're not sure it's going to actually lead to good results. But when someone like Hess, and then Peterson, and then Clay Christensen, and Chubb and Moe are all saying, yeah, this is something important, and then I read these Race to the Top applications, and it becomes pretty clear that you can actually use e-learning to not only give families choices, but actually better distribute high quality teachers, so a great teacher can not only teach 30 kids but maybe 3,000 kids. So I'm still not completely convinced that it's necessarily going to lead to better results, but it's something that I've undug my heels, and I'm willing to say that, yeah, if we do this carefully, it might be much better than I expected, say, 2 years ago.
Well, you know, there's another way to look at this too, Andy, is that it doesn't have to get better results. It could get the same results at dramatically less cost.
Yep.
And we'd still be way out ahead. And, you know, we're in an era, and we're going to be in this era for a while, maybe almost forever, where school districts are going to have to do more with less. And I think they're going to be looking at these virtual school options in order to do that. And by and large, that's an okay thing. The one downside is, you know, just we're kind of where we were at in the charter movement 15 years ago. We don't see anybody thinking ahead to sort of what are the policies that need to be in place to make it more likely that these virtual schools are going to be of high quality and are going to have room to grow. Look for Fordham to be doing some work on that in the future.
One other thing, in the I-3 application, there are a lot of people who are concerned that for-profit companies are severely disadvantaged when it comes to trying to get this funding to do innovation. And for better or for worse, some of the best e-learning groups are completely for-profit. So it sort of suggests that this area that there could be great growth in may be inhibited because I-3 was written in such a way that groups like K-12 and others might not be able to access these funds.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Well played. That is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for our special Research Minute. Intern Daniela, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Daniela.
Now, see, you didn't know this because you have only been around Fordham for so long, but, you know, when Amber first started out, it was only the research half minute, and it was only with growing confidence over time that we've expanded to the research minute. So, Andy, what do you think? Should we go dial back the clock to 30 seconds? I'm just kidding. Stafford's protesting. That's not true.
She's got a good one, too.
She's got to go. Oh, really?
Yeah, well, we should break out the watch, though.
You've taken a sneak peek. Okay, Danielle, you know how this works. You've got 60 seconds to get in your review. Are you ready?
She looks worried.
Yep, I got the time.
It's all fake.
Come on. That is smoke and mirrors. This is what we're all about.
On your marks. Get set. Go, Danielle. Go.
So today we're looking at an interim evaluation of No Child Left Behind from the Institute of Policy Research at Northwestern. The study looks at both main NAEP and trend NAEP data to evaluate student achievement before and after the implementation of NCLB. And the authors break up the NAEP data into two time frames, both pre and post NCLB implementation, and using both Catholic schools and non-Catholic private schools as their two control groups, the research finds a causal relationship between policies implemented in public schools for NCLB and improved NAEP scores for grades 4 and 8 math. Say they didn't look at grade 12, which was the other year that NAEP assessed students. For math, grade 4 students gained 6 to 7 months of math know-how during NCLB, and in grade 8, the students were a full 12 months ahead of their counterparts from years prior to NCLB. Unfortunately, the reading results weren't so conclusive. The authors found minimally improved reading scores in grades 4 only, and only if sanctions were both enacted in 2002 and if there were high student proficiency standards. So these are a lot of ifs, and no one else has ever found improved reading scores because of NCLB. So the authors understand that there might be more to do for reading. Methodologically, the research tackles multiple variables and tries to account for all possible question marks. It uses two control groups, and the large sample size, though not randomly assigned, does help prove statistical significance. So overall, a sound piece of research and well worth the read.
Well done, Daniela, on the
well
time.
Well done.
But let's unpack this. First of all, the most important question. Why did Amber get called for jury duty? I mean, what is up with that?
She's a good, upstanding citizen, good judgment.
Shout out to Amber, in case you're listening to the show on your long, long drive home from the courthouse. Okay, so Danielle, let's unpack this. So my understanding is they were doing a couple of things. First is they were looking at a group of states that were sort of high accountability states versus low accountability states.
They looked at everything. They looked at trend data at the national level. They looked at main NAEP data at the state level. They looked at everything.
Okay. And one thing that they were teasing out, though, is that in states that took sanctions more seriously and had high cut scores, that you saw more movement in those states?
Yeah, those two different variables.
Okay. In the NCLB era, mm-hmm. You saw that.
Oh, pre and post.
Both pre and post.
They started in 1990, went to 2009, and... Yeah, checked it at 2002, the implementation of NCLB, checked pre and then post.
Okay. So, I mean, I think this is the first time we've ever seen any relationship between sort of high cut scores, aka high standards, and higher student achievement.
It seems to make sense because standards on their own can be meaningless in terms of accountability if you actually don't have these cut scores or you don't take them seriously with sanctions. Mm-hmm. But actually, cut scores are meaningful because a county, a district, or a school actually has to realize not only do we have high standards, but we have to get 75% of our kids passing them, not 25% or 10%. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's interesting that these two factors, standards and sanctions, or cut scores and sanctions, actually matter. But again, we're seeing that it's easier, relatively, to move math scores than reading scores. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this kind of confirms just a general, if somewhat blurry, interpretation of NCLB.
And keep in mind, those math results are on a NAEP that is very much focused on the sort of NCTM kind of math, as are most state standards. So there's kind of the alignment, for better or for worse, there that might be driving it. Danielle, I mean, what do you think about this idea of comparing the public school trends to these private school and Catholic school trends? I mean, what was their rationale for using those as the control groups?
The rationale was that the private schools and the Catholic schools weren't affected quite so much by NCLB. They would be a little bit more of a solid barometer.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think I'd more or less buy it. I mean, you got to wonder, you know, if the kids going to Catholic schools or private schools have changed over time and how you measure and account for all that kind of
stuff.
That's
a good question. And then there are other, like in New York City's Catholic schools, they take the state test. Yeah. And I think in Milwaukee, at least a voucher program, some of them take the state test as well. So there is some blur between the two. But I mean, I think we have to give the researchers some credit that they tried to use a novel method.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, Daniela, very well done. This is a tough assignment. You did it well. We think Amber will be back next week, unless the trial is the trial of the century and goes on and on and on and on.
So the song this week is Hurt So Good by John Mellencamp, and we chose it because sometimes these tough interventions like high standards and negative sanctions can lead to great results. Oh, baby, make it hurt so good. Sometimes it hurts.
Looks so good. Ah, Mellencamp. I love Mellencamp. One of my all-time favorites.
Hmm.
Growing up in the suburbs outside St. Louis.
That's right, you're a Midwestern boy, yeah. So you should like him.
I was born in a small town, which wasn't true because I was actually born in Boston and then lived in a big suburb. But we had corn nearby, and so I kind of felt the connection.
So speaking of blue-collar rockers, Stafford, you're from New York, so are you a bigger Bruce Springsteen fan than John Mellencamp with or without the Cougar?
Yes, in fact, I am.
You're a Springsteen fan?
I am. Springsteen is the man.
What's your favorite Springsteen album?
Hold on. We've got something to do, which is let's hear for that reform. Hold on. Andy, are you a big Springsteen fan?
Talking over the song?
I would so much rather replace that song with a Bruce Springsteen or a John Cougar Mellencamp song.
But you like Springsteen?
I am a Springsteen fan.
Laura gave me a selection of five songs. I thought the song had a little pep. It was good for dancing.
Andy, you know where they have a lot of Springsteen
you
fans?
You don't dance.
Where's that?
New Jersey.
Oh, cut it out.
Okay, Stafford, what reform are we going to rate today?
Well, first there was the Peace Corps, and then came AmeriCorps, and finally there was the Teach for America Corps. But what about a corps for the elderly? We've got Experience Corps, which has the answer to this question. It's a tutoring program that connects individuals over the age of 55 with urban public school students. They have operations in 22 cities and 2,000 volunteers nationwide. Tutors generally work about 15 hours a week and receive an annual stipend of $2,800 to cover the cost of transportation and materials. Interesting thing about this program is that according to recent research, both students and tutors benefit. Students' reading achievement notably improves. There is no data in math. And the elderly participants are kept mentally acute and physically active. Some even report that the program has saved their lives. So this program sounds like a win-win to me. I think it's great, of course, that we're offering the elderly an outfit for their post-retirement free time and improving student achievement simultaneously. But that's all gravy. Here's what I like the most. This program is open to anyone over the age of 55, and there are only a few, mostly civil service jobs, that retire that early. This may sound callous, but a retirement age of 55 is, to my mind, absurd. And so I'm glad we're putting these folks who are now living off my Social Security contributions to good use. And since we're also keeping these folks physically active and mentally aware, we're lowering the cost of later life health care, specifically Medicare, another drain on the currently employed's paycheck. I also like that the program attempts to address multiple problems at once in a relatively cost-effective way. So since this program does relatively well on both my grading metrics, it addresses the problem it's supposed to address, and some additional problems besides, and it does it in a cost-effective way and seems to be successful, I gave it an A.
Ooh. Tea Party Palmieri.
I thought you'd enjoy that.
Wow.
And not only she angered so many people with that,
right?
She kept referring to people 55 and older as elderly.
They refer to themselves as elderly. This program calls
55?
Them the elderly.
Bring on the letters to the editor there.
Stafford. I'm sorry. The retirement age, a retirement of age of 55 is absurd. It is absurd. You cannot start getting your pension at 55.
Yes, I agree. And this happens in education. And now you can't blame the people because they have huge incentives to retire that early. We have built that into the system. It's the system's fault, Stafford. That's why you work at a think tank to change the system.
But I still think that those people could contribute back to society, whether or not it is their fault they are retiring that
By early. The way, they don't get Social Security at 55.
That's true.
All right.
No, anyway, so they've actually done some really interesting studies. There was one from the University of Washington, St. Louis, that looked at the effect of this program on reading achievement. Mm-hmm. There was another study, I'm forgetting from where it was from, that actually looked on the effect of the program on the health of the people who participate, and that it actually is a great physical sort of exertion for them, and it's better than doing crosswords to keep their minds humming. So,
yeah, the first George Bush jumped out of an airplane at, 80? Was that it? Now, that sounds like physical exertion. Wandering down to some town. I'm just teasing. All right, thank you, Stafford. That was a good one. I like that.
She got fired up. I know.
I think she almost wanted to give somebody a pink slip. Like the old Jeff Koonin days.
By the way, I was driving down Route 50 coming back from Easter this weekend, and I saw an advertisement on the side of the Washington Times for Jeff Kooner's radio show.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. I had no idea.
See, Andy, someday you might have your own radio show, too. This is where people from the Education Gadfly Show, they get their start here, and who knows where they end up.
Wow. And if I ever need an angry contributor, I know who to get.
All right. That is way more. We are way short on time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Till then.
I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net, signing off.